You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/savewatersantafe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. This program is brought to you by Total Wine and More. With locations in Santa Fe and Albuquerque, each store has about 8,000 different wines from all over the world, and thousands of beers, including both major brands and microbrews and imported beers. And they have more than 3,000 different kinds of spirits, all at the lowest prices you'll find, and with a trained, knowledgeable staff. They're on the web at totalwine.com, and you can order for in-store pickup. And if you use my promo code, you can save even more. Use code 6979 at the store or online and receive $10 off on your next $50 purchase. That's code 6979. Thanks again to Total Wine and More for sponsoring the Radio Cafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Lidia Cacho. She is a Mexican journalist, feminist, and human rights activist. And Marcela Zendejas, she is a documentary filmmaker and human rights activist, also from Mexico. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. So happy to be here.
So, Lidia, you became a journalist at a time when women were not necessarily doing investigative crime stories. In your book, you write about how an editor told you you should do the society pages because you were pretty. And how did you get on the path that led you to uncover a pedophilia ring, a child pornography ring?
Well, it was pretty soon in my career when my editor sent me to the Mayan Riviera to interview women, Mayan women, to see how tourism had a good impact in their lives. I went there to talk about economy and all this. And all they wanted to talk about was child abuse, and the husbands were really aggressive to them, and family violence. So I made my first piece on that, and I went back to my editor, and he said, "What are you talking about? This is private stuff. You shouldn't talk about what happens inside families." And this is almost 30 years ago. And I said, that's not right. I should find out. So I started studying some law. I got myself some law books and started understanding a lot more about domestic violence and what the laws were all about. From there, it took me to the path of understanding how child abuse, how different forms of child abuse were happening, not only in these areas, indigenous areas in Quintana Roo, where Cancun and Playa del Carmen are, but also within the tourism industry. So I just got myself involved in that, and then I just started reading and reading more and more and getting great sources and trying to understand it better and going to specialists to try to understand the phenomena. And all of a sudden, I said, okay, I have to study how organized crime works. So I studied criminology, and that's how I got sort of specialized in that.
Were your editors resistant to publishing these stories?
Absolutely, always, almost always. Because, I mean, 30 years ago, most of the newspapers were ruled by men. There were very few women in there, except for the secretary and the phone girl, and probably the society pages.
Right.
There weren't many reporters in Mexico, female reporters. And if they were, they would never give us the possibility to cover politics or economy or crime, anything similar to that. It was like a man's job. So I did. I got a lot of resistance. And then on top of that, I kept saying I was a feminist. So every time I got to the newspaper, in the many newspapers I worked, first 6 or 7 years, they kept telling me, oh, here comes a feminist again with the same stories about children and women and, you know, women's rights and stuff like that.
Which is amazing because when you think about, I mean, all of these people have children and they wouldn't want that to happen to their children.
Well, obviously, but on the other hand, I've always been a feminist since I was 15 years old because of my mom was a feminist and she educated all of us, my brothers and sisters, like that. So the kind of journalism that I do now that seems so natural 30 years ago was very strange to everyone because it was really journalism written with a feminist and human rights perspective. I didn't know that back then, but I was doing that. And they got angry at me. Even one of my editors, one day just threw my investigation in my face like that. And he said, what do you think you want? You want to take the power away from the husbands or something like that? He was so angry because it hit on them, on their personal life. Because I was talking about not only domestic violence or child abuse, but I was talking about power abuse by the macho society, by the machism cultural values in Mexico. So they were very angry at that.
Of course, what it really boils down to in a lot of ways is organized crime, and you write about that. And in retaliation for exposing some horrible, horrible situations that have to do with, I mean, small children, young girls and boys also being raped and photographed and videoed and just inconceivably horrible things that these children endured and that you found out. In retaliation for exposing this, you were at a certain point raped, beaten, left for dead. And I'm guessing that this was not only an attempt to silence you, which didn't work, but also an attempt to silence other journalists to get them to self-censor. Talk about the dangers to journalists in Mexico, how you responded, how journalists are responding to that kind of threat against them.
Well, back then when it happened to me, journalists were not really talking about that, attacks against them, because it was something the editors said we shouldn't do. So the first thing I did was I wrote my column. Once I was safe and out of the hospital, I talked to my family and I said, I'm going to write my column about it. And my husband said, you know what it will mean? A lot of people will attack you or laugh at you, or a social network didn't exist back then, but I'm sure they would have if they existed. And I wrote it because I wanted to make people understand that when you are a victim of sexual violence, you are not the guilty one. And the response was overwhelmingly amazing by men and women that read it. And it started making me understand that we should talk more about it. And a lot of journalists around me said, this is very brave how you did it. And then I started getting some help from organizations. But back then, I have to say, there weren't any organization like the one Marcela worked at Article 19 and things like that, because violence against journalists back then was very silenced, because a lot of journalists in Mexico are linked to the powers to be. They are linked to the system. They are paid by the system, and they're very corrupted too. So, and that made it very complex. Nowadays, it's different.
Mm-hmm. Oh, well, regarding your question about how are journalists responding to the violence, I think what Lydia says is true. During the first years of 2000, 2005, the violence was strong, but there was not a lot of organizations looking after them. But after 5 or 6 years, this was 2010, 2013, where the violence was still really strong, I think what we saw was journalists beginning to realize that the only way out was to organize themselves. So you see a group which I think normally doesn't work well collectively, I may say, at least in Mexico or Latin America, you know, like people, the reporters are, you know, they go alone and they do their work and, you know, but I think naturally it's not something you see. But what we saw in Mexico was organization. Okay, so journalists started talking to each other after they saw their friends being assassinated, right? It was before you saw, they've witnessed firsthand their friends being attacked and murdered or disappeared. So how they responded was by organizing themselves. No, but the cost was too high at that point. For me, another thing that was really, really strong was that the idea of breaking news regarding certain sources was death. Because you couldn't go and, for example, report on something that was really dangerous on your own, that they had to organize themselves and go in a group. And that also changed the dynamics of journalism a lot. So these journalists, photojournalists, I worked with photojournalists really closely, and they were the ones that were in the front lines, no? So reporting this really hardcore news. And they started telling their bosses and their editors that they were not going alone. They were going as a group with other reporters from other media, which were, quote-unquote, their competition, no? So, yes, I think that's the beginning of something really important in Mexico that we saw. This was, I think, the year 2010, and until now, they have managed to organize themselves and to create really important efforts against the violence.
And there's still so much violence. I mean, yes. You've had, both of you, friends die, journalists who have been assassinated.
Yes.
Yeah, many friends. I was thinking, yesterday my phone rang in the morning, and it was a call from Chihuahua, and I didn't answer. But I felt the fear, because almost every time I get a call from certain places like Tamaulipas or Chihuahua, it's because some of our friends have been assassinated. It happened last year. First, they called us to tell us, like in a three-month period, three of my friends were assassinated. And it's their husbands or their wives, if it's a man, or a friend or the editor, the one that calls me to let me know. And sometimes the kids. But in the last years, we have more than 170 journalists assassinated or disappeared. Yeah, it breaks your heart, of course. And then at least I personally have been going to therapy, working on my survivor guilt.
Yeah, yeah. You describe in the book Infamy, which is riveting, by the way. I picked this up last night and stayed up almost all night reading it. But anyway, it's called Infamy, How One Woman Brought an International Sex Trafficking Ring to Justice. One of the things that you talk about is the importance of listening to children. You had a girl who had the courage to reach out to you, and you listened to her story. And whereas a lot of people are teaching that you have to have a sort of cool journalistic objectivity, you had to open your heart to her, not only because you were a human being and she was a human being, and here you were in this situation where the girl was beside herself with fear and grief and anger and vulnerability, but also that's how you tell the story.
Exactly. I think that we women journalists around the world have not really recognized the impact that our presence in media all over the world has done to not only journalism, but the way society speaks and talks. We have actually changed journalism for the better. We have brought human rights journalism to the table. All the issues that were not supposed to be news or important, we brought them to the table. We brought the idea of discussing economy from the perspective of the woman that goes to the market and knows exactly how badly paid is she or her family or her partner or husband or whatever, because she's the one that handles the home economy. And before that, no male journalist was even thinking about that. So we did change the map of journalism, and that's something that we had to celebrate as females all over the world, because in Iraq, in Mexico, in the U.S., in Colombia, in France, everywhere, we did that. It's the new narrative. And I think that that is something to celebrate on one hand, but on the other hand, we are being punished for that in many places. Maybe not so much in the U.S., although I think in some cases, some journalists are. But certainly in other countries where I have friends, I've been doing journalist trainings all over the world. I've gone to Afghanistan, to Iraq, and to Spain, etc. And I see exactly the same problems everywhere. It's like they get punished with violence, with threats, because they are doing this kind of journalism that is questioning the system, the patriarchal system and the way things work and the politics of it all. For example, the war against drugs. It's in Colombia and in Mexico. It's mainly women, the ones that have truly, truly fought against it, because we are the ones losing our children and our partners and our families and our homes because of the war against drugs, in which people are making money in the U.S. and in Mexico with guns and the business of war. And we know it, and we're the ones discussing that.
Now, you, Lydia, and Marcela came up with the idea of doing a series of short documentaries about children all around Mexico. It's called Somos Valientes, which means we are brave. It's on the web at somosvalientes.mx. Tell us about the concept of this series, what the idea was, and what your hopes are for it.
Well, a while ago, many, many years ago, I was working traveling in Norway, and I met this amazing man called Johan Galtung, who is the teacher, the biggest expert around the world on peace education and peace journalism. He's a philosopher. And I talked to him, and then I trained with him, and I kept on learning more and more about peace journalism. So I integrated it into my work. And then after some years, and having all my diaries with all these stories of resilience of the kids that I encounter during my trips documenting human trafficking all over the world, including the U.S., of course, I was wondering, how come these kids are so resilient on one hand, and how come they are so aware of the political situation in their own countries or in the countries they're brought to when they are, trafficked? And it puzzled me. And then I won an award in New York, and the money was to use it for something related to journalism. And I sat down with Marcela, whom I met and worked before with, and I said, let's do something like a documentary and talk about this, the resilience of kids, how they do it, and what kind of a society will they build? All these millions of children that have been trafficked or battered or raped or whatever, or not, but live in a very violent society. Like in the U.S., the boys and girls that are confronting like gunshotting in their own schools.
Right.
So Marcela said, no, a documentary, no. Let's do a short stories, like a mini series. And here we are.
How did you find the children whom you interviewed?
What we did was, the idea and the concept behind the whole project is to find and interview kids that are part of organizations from organized civil society in Mexico. Because what we really wanted to do as well was not only tell the stories, but also tell the stories of the organizations and the groups that are already making something different or thinking outside the box, with the mission of transforming the reality of their own local communities. So in a way, you know, like the short films, every short film, they last around from 10 to 14 minute long videos. What we do is we tell the story of a boy and a girl. They tell a bravery story about how they felt brave at a certain point in their life. And we also, they are the ones that explain the organization that they're part of. So there are no adults in the videos except for Lydia. She's the one that interviews and hosts the whole video and takes us throughout the journey through five different cities. And that's how we selected the kids, the boys and girls that you can see in the series, by looking for those organizations that we really believe in and that we really believe that people have to know and have to support.
And it's also organizations that work in one way or another towards creating peace education. And that was really important for us, that what they do, they are working outside the box regarding work with kids. And they are giving them their own voice. They are respecting that. They work on equality, for example. And we wanted to know if that worked, if that really worked. We also looked for organizations that were not inducting kids, inducing kids into saying things or training kids like in traditional education. We wanted organizations or schools that were like the blind kids school in Guadalajara.
Yeah, that's such a moving piece. These blind children who are so in their own power, even though they're blind.
Right.
Isn't it? It was, the whole thing was even, you can say magical, because when we were talking to boys and girls in Mexico City, after they saw one chapter, we asked them, what would you like to see? Because of course, the first time we were like asking ourselves, are the young people going to watch this? Are we crazy? Are they going to say, well, you know, we have Netflix, we have another platforms, this is ridiculous. And when they watched this, they were just fascinated by it, and we were so glad. And when we asked them, what would you like to see? And one of the little boys said, I would love to see and know what blind children think about Mexico. So we looked for this school, and you have this 10-year-old girl, as you saw, talking about Trump, analyzing the Trump politics, because she listens to the radio all day and to what's happening, the reaction that Mexicans have had to Donald Trump. So it has been such an experience that we decided to create a platform, which is an educational platform in which you can see all the chapters of the miniseries. Now we have this first season, which is 5 chapters. And you can download all these tools that talk about emotions. What emotions does this documentary makes you feel? And work on that with your family, with your kids at school, in any kind of group, even with adults, because we don't recognize, if, for example, anyone that is listening to this radio program, if you watch a documentary on something that is going on anywhere in the world or even in your country, you're overwhelmed and you say, oh my God, well, I want to do something about it. And then all of a sudden you know you can't because there's nothing linking you to it. And we wanted to do a platform that link people to those organizations, to those kids, but also to their own emotions. So it's an emotional education platform too, made by experts on that. All these experts join us to do the tools.
I remember when I was in my early 20s, I had this big insight that emotional understanding and intellectual understanding were not separate, and that you needed one to have, at least I needed one to have the other, that I could not understand things through a purely intellectual lens. And I feel like what you're doing and the kind of journalism and the kind of documentary that you both are doing are true documentary and truly emotional, but not emotional at the expense of true journalism, fact-finding, and genuine important storytelling. And I think that maybe it's, you know, as you say, this is what women are doing in journalism. Like, that's the new path that's being walked right now by you and so many others. But it just feels like such an, on the one hand, obvious, but really creative and important way of telling stories and making change.
Right. Yes, we hope so. There's a tendency that comes from Norway and Sweden of experts, male and female, that are working on this thing called emotional education, linked to peace education and to transforming the educational system all over the world, because it really doesn't work. It's inductive, it's in the traditional system. We know that it's not really creating better human beings. They're just educating them in certain areas, like feeding the mind, but not necessarily feeding the emotional maturity of children. So using these new ideas of all these experts, we tapped into that and tried to add it to the platform. Because Johan Galtung always says that studies appeal to the mind and emotions appeal to the heart. And once we understand that and we develop strategies to unify those two, we will create a generation of emotionally healthy human beings that don't want war, that will not express themselves through violence but through peace, that will be able to mediate when somebody is being violent. And there's so many evidence, scientific evidence to that we studied to do this platform, that we are really hopeful that this is not only the first platform like that, but that people can copy it and reproduce it and do things like that, because we need that.
Some of the children in the series talk about not wanting to be at war. What is their experience of war?
Well, specifically, there are 2 episodes of kids that have been witnessing violence throughout their whole lives. That is the one from Sinaloa, the northern part of Mexico, and the other for me is Mexico City. So specifically in those 2 episodes, we see kids that have been brought in an environment and raised up in an environment, a very violent environment, that specifically it has to do with organized crime and the war against drugs, no? So, for example, in Sinaloa, you see kids. We did the episode in one of Culiacan's most violent neighborhoods. Now, this is the northern part of Mexico, where the drug cartel's presence is absolute. Now, so the law is really the narcos. So you see these kids that have been, so they live with that, right? So the people that they see in the streets are part of the gangs, and their family members are part of the gangs. And what we saw there is that the biggest problem is that they don't have like a lot of reference or examples of people who have been successful in other things that don't have to do with drugs. So that is a problem, a huge problem. So they live in the environment of war. They live it all day long. Or they know people that have been murdered. Most of these have absent fathers, but not only because they've left, but because they have been killed as well. So you see these kids that are left alone because their mothers and grandmothers and aunts have to work as well. So they are on the streets and they have two options. They either do homework and stay at their houses with nobody watching them, or they go out on the streets. No, and those kids are the ones that are kidnapped or lured in by the gangs. And this is the reality. But also, that we think that it's important to understand that reality. But as you saw, the episodes focus on what are people doing on those neighborhoods. So the story really is to highlight the positive things that are going on in that neighborhood that I just described, which I'm sure nobody wants to be there. But there are amazing people who are transforming it, and they're giving options to those kids. So they're saying, okay, no one, not even us, when we were young, we wanted to do homework at our houses. So what they do is they offer martial art classes, and in exchange, the kids, they have to stay and do homework, and they have to stay in school. So what they're targeting is the permanence of these kids in school, no? Because that's the only way in which they will break the cycle of violence. And it's really working. And these kids, as you asked, no? They experience war every day in their own skin when they go outside their houses, on the streets. And the story here for us also is how these cycles of violence are being broken, at least in some cases. Of course, I'm not saying that the violence is going to disappear anytime soon or whatever, but we saw specific cases on how throughout, for example, sports, throughout culture, throughout the empowerment of these kids in these really simple things for us, because maybe you all have had the opportunity of going to attending a sport class or a sport lesson, but for them, it's making the whole difference, no, in their lives.
Well, there's a girl who you show in the Sinaloa segment. She's a student of martial arts, and she, in a tournament, beats a boy who's humiliated, and it almost looks like she's surprised herself that she was able to do that. And you just think, this girl is going to grow up to be really something. And there's a boy in that same segment, I think his name is Luis, who he looks like a tough kid. He wants to be a cop, and he wants to be a good cop. And he understands corruption, and he understands what it is to save lives. It's incredibly moving.
It is. And the other thing that is important that we learn is how these boys and girls explain war in Mexico. When they talk about fearing war, for example, the kids in Mexico City, they talk about the war against between the gangs, the drug gangs around them, because they live in the slums in Mexico City. And for them, that is war. The fact that all these different groups are trying to kill each other, and they are surrounded by these people. So that is war for them. But also, you can see this amazing boy in Mexico City that talks about helping others and becoming, well, he already works as an assistant to firefighters because they fight a fire when they were younger. But he also talks about his fear of being disappeared because they are very close to the stories of the Ayotzinapa students and to many, many. They are not the only ones. They are the most famous. But for years and years, hundreds of people have been disappeared in Mexico. And we are not talking about the people who disappear them. But we do know that some of them are the police, some of them are corrupted military, and some of them are organized crime. And these kids have it very clear. And they know that is war, some kind of war, a war against humanity, which is a war of corrupted police, corrupted military, and corrupted politicians. And that's why many of them want to become good military. They said, I want to be a soldier, but a good soldier, or not a soldier, because I heard about the corrupted soldiers. So that's war for them. War, in their own words, when they talk in every different state where we went, they talk about war as phenomena around them or in the whole country that is not allowing them to think of the future and of freedom. And that is what we wanted to show in our miniseries, to explain people. War is not only this crazy guy saying he's going to send a nuclear bomb. War is what happens every day in your community when you are afraid that somebody's going to come into your school and kill your kids.
Marcela, how did you become a human rights activist?
I became a human rights activist in 2006. I was in the middle of university, and I stopped university. I told my parents that I didn't want to be there anymore. And I went as a volunteer to Oaxaca, to the jungle part, and I became a teacher. I became a teacher in an indigenous community. I was 20 years old at that time. And how did I become a journalist? For me, it was the realization, which I think existed always in my heart, of the social injustice that my country lives in. I think I'm part of a generation that has this, maybe it's guilt, the guilt of social injustice, and the motivation of doing something about it. No? So we've heard our parents complain, and the parents of them complaining about how bad things are, but also them argumenting that things cannot change and that things have always been the same. And I think you see now a generation of people that say that can't be possible, right? It was like, how can you say that things will never change? Things are changing every day. And if you hold that argument, then things are never going to change, really. So I think I had the conviction of that I could do something about what I saw. So I started my job as an activist, as a teacher in a rural community. And then I started working with organizations that have to do with protecting journalists that were being attacked. So that is kind of my path. And then that's how I met Lydia.
Lydia, you've talked about how the newly elected Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, is having a kind of Obama moment. And there's a lot of hope, but that people also tend to put leaders on a pedestal and then knock them down when they turn out not to be superhuman, all-powerful superheroes, which nobody is. What are your hopes and what are your concerns about the coming administration?
Well, first of all, Andrés Manuel is a pretty conservative guy. I laugh a little when people say that he wants to turn Mexico into Venezuela, the Venezuela that we know now with all the crisis, with the food crisis and the violent crisis and the democratic crisis. He is very intelligent. He is very obsessed with the way history will judge him, as many politicians are, but he's especially preoccupied with that. And he kept saying it openly to the media. He has appointed very good people in his cabinet by now. He will take office in December. So by now it's like the transitional cabinet. And he's doing good. He's doing well. What I think that as his weaknesses is he's not very pro. This is a contradiction, but it's the truth. All politicians are contradictory, of course. He's not very pro-feminist, meaning he is not openly pro-sexual and reproductive rights. He never talked about that during his campaign. We tried to force him to do so, and he always said, we will bring this to society and society will decide. And we were like, no way, this is not the way it goes. You have to bring this to the Senate and to Congress, and they will decide with the people, but this is not something that you bring to the streets. So that will be one of the biggest challenges, women's rights. He said that he will change the educational system completely. We'll see. If he does that, he will do a wonderful thing for Mexico, but it's only 6 years, as we know. And if he doesn't, if he really is not able to transform the educational system, at least, and the human rights violations and the justice system, then things will not truly change. He has not addressed the war against drug yet, as we expect. And he must do it in the next few months with a plan to not only address it, but with a plan to stop the war against drugs, which means that he has to change the whole relationship with the American government, because it is the American government, the one that brought the Merida plan to Mexico to implement the war against drugs. The so-called war against drugs in Mexico, who is killing and making people disappear all over the country. So I think those are my main concerns. If he doesn't present a plan on how to tackle that and how he will deal with his relationship with such a complex government as one you have right now in the U.S., then I do not see a way out of this war against drug, which is nothing else but a plan between the American government and the Mexican military to make the military become the Mexican police and militarize Mexico and criminalize the poor, and, you know, on one hand killing people and on the other hand abiding and allowing all these drugs to come to the U.S. because this U.S. is, of course, as we all know, the biggest consumer of drugs that go through Mexico. So that is my main concern, because if they don't change that pattern, all these disappearances and all these organized crime deals and the way organized crime works will not change, because the difference between organized crime here in Mexico to the other countries is very clear. It's organized crime is inside politics, like in Italy, like in the US, like everywhere. But what happens is that they there to kill anyone that doesn't think like them or that is endangering their own business in formal politics and outside in organized crime. So he has to tackle that. I don't see how he will, but hopefully he will.
What you talk about, the militarization of the police and criminalization of poverty, I mean, we're dealing with those same things right here in this country, even though I think we're a little more in denial about it here than perhaps you are in Mexico. And I mean, you look at the reality of organized crime and the fact that the U.S. is the primary consumer of drugs, of pornography, of child pornography. They're involved in pedophilia, tourism. I mean, things that are so counter to human nature, really. I mean, it's our nature as human beings to live in community and protect one another. That's how we evolved. And we got here through some combination of greed and violence and how those things interact. And I mean, you in particular, having been the victim of violence against you for the kind of work you do, but both of you and everybody who's doing the kind of work that you do, you have to learn to deal somehow with the rage, with the grief, with the anger, with the fear, and to be resilient. How do you do that? And in your case, how do you heal from the violence that's been perpetrated against you?
My mother was a feminist activist psychologist, so I've always been in therapy all my life, first, of course, related to my family and my mom trying to let us know that mental health was the main thing in our life and should be the main thing. And I'm really grateful for that, because that really changed my life. I've been in therapy for 30 years, different kinds of therapy. I write, I paint, I do things that I consciously created in my life to have beauty and art surrounding me, because I knew that should always be something that fed my soul, my heart, my spirituality. I've been doing yoga for 30 years and meditate every day. And I do it because I want to stay healthy. I don't keep rage inside me. And anytime I feel indignant, which is one day after another, seeing everything that is happening not only in my country but everywhere, what I do is I ask myself what I'm going to do about it, because that's what my mom used to do to us when I was 10 years old, and she would take us to the slums in Mexico City to work with the women and talk about sexual health and reproductive rights with them. My mom used to bring us there, and I would truly suffer when I was like 10, 11, and we would go back home, and I said, Mom, I don't get it. Why do these little boys and girls don't have clothing? They don't eat properly. Why do we, even though we're middle class, but why do we have all this, and they don't even have a home? They live in the slums. My mom said, this is poverty, and you have to ask yourself, what will you do about it when you grow up? So that is my everyday question. When I get angry, I said, okay, I'm getting angry. What am I going to do about it? And then I go put myself into working onto that, on link to other organizations, for example, with the children now in the U.S., with other organizations that are doing work. What can I do to help and get all these therapists and mental health experts to work in the border to help the parents of a family separation and things like that? So I do believe that if you are not spiritually healthy, you cannot truly be a long-term effective human rights activist, a long-term effective journalist.
Are you taking lessons from Lydia?
Yes, for sure. I mean, I think my generation of activists, we have learned, and we have to learn so much from the ones that are above us. And I think we've learned the lessons, the good ones, and from the good experiences that they've had and from the bad ones. And to your previous question, for me, it has been about dignifying the anger or the rage. There's a really powerful phrase that the women, the Zapatista women, hold, that is la digna rabia, which is to dignify anger or rage. And it is so powerful to me, that phrase has always been, because there's like this secret or this key on how to transform anger into actions. So that is dignifying anger. You can be angry your whole life, but that doesn't take you anywhere. The real secret is to know that anger, indignation, rage should trigger action, should trigger creativity, imagination, but not the thirst of vengeance or anything else, but really the other way around. No, I always say that we don't have to tell kids to stop to be angry. We just have to tell them how to transform that anger into another thing, into imagining that things can be different.
Can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if they use the term millennial in Mexico, but you're of this generation, people mm-hmm. in their 20s and 30s. Do you see a different political consciousness, social consciousness among young Mexicans?
Yes, for sure. I think, first of all, we are more informed and people are participating more. There's the two sides of every story, right? I think there is a group of people from the millennial generation who are just apathetic, they don't want to be involved in politics, who are like the younger millennials. And I think the older millennials are involved, they are really informed, and they talk about things. The thing is, and the trick is, to really understand that being politically active doesn't mean social media only, no? We always talk about how, yes, you can be really political in your social media and post, you know, all this interesting stories and whatever, and invent hashtags, but we have also to land those ideas and to go out on the streets and take public spaces and all that. No? So how to transform that the politics that happen on the internet into the politics that we want to see on the streets? And that is, I think, the biggest challenge that we have as a generation. But for example, in Mexico, during this election, no, this was the big question: are millennials or are young people going to vote? And I was involved in several interviews that had to do with really young people that were voting for the first time. And I was really scared because they told me that they didn't know who to vote. They didn't know if they wanted to vote. They didn't believe in anything. These are centennials. So younger people, no? 18-year-old kids.
First-time voters.
First-time voters. So the big surprise was this was the biggest turnout of millennials voting. So millennials did vote this presidential election, and I think it was because we were so afraid that that we were going to see what happened in the U.S. happen to us. No? So these bubbles in the internet where you were sure that one candidate was one who was going to win, and then all of a sudden the result came out completely different to what they were expecting. So there was a conscience regarding that. No? So people went out to the streets and vote. So, yes, I think, as I said, there are millennials that are really politically active. The biggest challenge for us is how to stop thinking that everything happens online, especially in Mexico, where the majority of people don't have even access to the internet. No? So breaking those bubbles and understanding that our reality is really diverse.
Everything that you are both talking about are lessons that we need to learn in the U.S., the whole question of strengthening our institutions, whether it be in Mexico or the U.S. or any other country, and having those institutions be strong enough that they're really representing people and not just representing power, money, guns, violence. You quote toward the end of the book Infamy, psychologist Carol Gilligan saying, "The opposite of patriarchy is democracy rooted in voice, not violence." So how do you encourage ordinary people to have that voice, to use that voice?
Well, what I've been doing for the last probably 20 years is going around not only Mexico, but I get invited all over the world to do conferences and workshops in many, many issues. If they invite me to a workshop on democratic values and the presence of women in those, or human rights activism, or how to tackle abuse of children or anything like that, I always integrate the personal power, the personal empowerment, how we discover our own abilities and how we make them possible and how we link to other people. One thing that I know for sure that has made my life so full and so interesting for a lot of people, but also what kept me alive, is the fact that I learned when I was a little girl that I always needed the others to change the world. This is not a job you do by yourself. You're just a part of a community. We're just like a little dust in the wind, and we need everyone to be there with us. So creating networks, that's my specialty. So that's what I did. For example, when I opened the shelter in Mexico City, nobody wanted to train me on that in Mexico. It was very strange because nobody really knew how to. So I went to Texas to the National Center for Domestic and Sexual Violence, and Debbie Tucker, who is now one of my best friends and my teacher, and I adore her, she trained me for months in order for me to open the shelter. And now we work together in a huge network that goes all the way from Texas to Cancun. And we have like 100 shelters for women and children. So networking is the key factor. If you have organizations, for example, in Santa Fe, and these organizations are unable or unwilling to work together and to surpass their own ego problems or their own, I don't know, differences. We are all different. If they are not able to do that, they will not be able to change their own community. Of course, Marcela and I were talking about racism in Mexico, the difference between racism and classism in Mexico and in the U.S. because of last night's talk with the Angelica Foundation and with the CCA. And Marcela said something that struck me last night, and is the fact that we in Mexico have like so many ethnic groups that work together. The fact that we have all these amazing organizations that are so different amongst them and work together in networks. We have learned to network whenever it's necessary to truly change, to mobilize people. And that is the thing. If we stay stuck in our own little lives. As an NGO, I say, I do this, but I don't want to share my power and blah. Then you are never going to really make an impact. So that's one thing that I always tell everyone. And I bring proof to it. You know, I demonstrate how it happened in Iraq, or the first time all this, when I was in Afghanistan, I was training all these amazing women in Afghanistan. They use the burqas to go save and rescue women, battered women in their own homes that were calling them. And one of them said, you know, I hold a gun. It's fantastic to have this burqa because I have a gun inside me. And I'm like, what? What do you mean? And she said, yes, because it's dangerous. But we went there and then rescued the woman and all dressed up like that. And nobody paid attention. And we rescued them and brought them to the shelters. So they are all working together. They might be religious, they might not be, but they are all against the Taliban and all against domestic violence. And it's extraordinary how they do it. And in other senses, they don't agree in many issues, but they are able to do it. So if you network, you will make Trump get out of office. I hope so.
Lidia Cacho and Marcela Zendejas, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you, thank you. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of the Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.